readers. Welcome to Books Connect Us from Penguin Random House. This is a podcast about staying connected with each other and the stories and authors who inspire us. On today's show, we have a conversation with Rolling Stone journalists Andy Green and Rob Sheffield, acclaimed author of Love is a Mixtape. The two discuss Andy's new book entitled The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. Which is an oral history of the beloved Steve Carell series. Andy and Rob talk about what made the show great, fascinating behind-the-scenes stories, and why The Office is as popular now as ever. Here's our Office discussion with Rob Sheffield and Andy Green.
All right, I'm here with Rob Sheffield, author of Dreaming the Beatles and Love is a Mixtape and lots of more great books. We're talking about my new book, The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. So thanks so much, Rob.
Thank you. What a great book. Thank you for writing it.
I think one thing that's so interesting is the show is almost bigger now than it's ever been. So how do you explain that?
Well, it's weird because like shows that have a long run, like The Office, we're used to a sort of slow build and then there's a peak phase and then they go on way too long. There's a lot of really terrible seasons, terrible episodes at the time. Happy Days went on really till the end of the 80s. It's astounding how long a show like that went on. And it's really a drag when you tune into a long running show with a lot of episodes and, you know, you get, you know, some of the sucky ones at the end. It's a real drag. And that's a sort of quintessential American disappointment that you learn as a kid. With The Office, the fact that they started so strong and they just had so many strong seasons. So the sheer abundance of like really great episodes. And there's, you know, a couple of seasons when it falls off, though, it falls off dramatically. It's not like there's a slow, sad decline.
Yeah, you're right. And I think something I've been thinking about this recently, that peak TV has given us so many amazing shows in the past 15 years or so. There's been great dramas. There's been great mysteries. There's been great docuseries. But there hasn't been a lot of great traditional sitcoms. Do you feel that way?
Yes. And also in terms of, like, that has something to do with quantity, but also quality. But the quantity is such a huge part of it. As you were saying before, that The Office did 26 episodes a year, whereas, you know, peak TV has kind of, like, gotten us more into a sort of filet mignon model where, you know, it's these, like, short seasons that are, you know, really like supposed to be finely crafted. I guess the sort of the Paul Simon approach to album making as opposed to the Neil Young approach. And The Office is more like, peak TV is more like the Paul Simon, Bruce Springsteen mode of like spend a few years and finesse every detail. Whereas The Office is, you know, we're going to crank it out. And so there's an absurd number of great episodes.
Yeah. And for context, I spent lots of time in the early period of working on this book thinking about the world of sitcoms in the early aughts, and like what I found was A, it was a horrible time, and B, every show was a Friends knockoff. That when The Office was being shopped around, like Friends was still on the air, it was getting a bit long in the tooth, but every network wanted a sitcom that was young, beautiful people in the big city that were just dating, having fun, and that laugh track was always going. I mean, it was a type of show that had gotten just so boring and bland, right?
Yeah, the network sitcom had become a really like devoid of fun sort of genre. It was either those sort of the Friends knockoffs or the family sitcoms, which looked so similar to, you know, everything about them was sort of frozen in time from the 70s.
Right, yeah, the family sitcom, it just didn't age. There was like 30 years of shows where it was just a kitchen and a living room and the dumb husband and the music cues and the laugh track. It was just hundreds of the same kind of show. I just think that it had just gotten to the end of where that worked. That shows like Full House and everything just weren't going to work anymore.
Yeah, and that's something like, you know, Home Improvement begat, you know, King of Queens, which begat According to Jim. These shows ran forever, and they were so terrible and so predictable that it was the kind of thing where even just a sort of fresh approach to something, you know, like a workplace comedy, and that was something that, you know, as you said, it was a terrible time for network sitcoms.
Yeah, Yeah, but and then also what happened in that time was that reality show started. So I think audiences, they got conditioned to a kind of show where it's a handheld camera and there's no laugh track, and the people who you see on the screen that you've seen get interviewed also, where they talk about the action on the screen. And I think that conditioned a bunch of people like to watch The Office and get that type of show.
Yeah. It was definitely like a sort of weirdly out of time kind of show. I mean, you mentioned the New York focus of the sort of the post-Friends shows. And even the family sitcoms were all New York or L.A. That even for this show to be set in Scranton was such a brilliant move that you wonder why nobody had ever thought of it before. But like 99% of sitcoms were set in New York or L.A.
And if you think of the basic premise of The Office, just imagine shopping this to a network. It's a show in Scranton, Pennsylvania, about the mundane, often sad lives of the employees at a struggling paper company, right? You couldn't think of a premise that a network is more likely to be like, good God, no. Yeah. So why do you think it works so well?
Hard to say. So much of it is the cast. Also just like the abundance of the cast. There's a lot of people in the show, and we get to know them very well a little bit at a time. Which is really kind of a audacious way to do it. You can only do it if you've got the cast to do it that way. But it was really amazing that you'd see people sort of in the corner of some episodes, and then some episodes they'd have a scene or just a line. But the way it sort of built that, you know, fictional world in a very painstaking way.
Yeah. And in doing this book, I really wanted to talk to the warehouse workers. You know, to these people who were basically glorified extras for year after year after year, but were there the whole time. And they had great stories. So a real fun part of the book for me was to tell from every possible angle. I wanted to know what Hide's life was like. You know, he was a Japanese heart surgeon. You know, that was a warehouse worker that had one scene ever, but was there for 7 years. And I had lots of fun doing that. And the caterer, he was key for me. I wanted to know their meals. I wanted to get down to the granular level of what was the breakfast menu in the morning. And that was just my favorite part of doing this book, was to just dig in as deep as I possibly could.
Yeah, well, and the mundane details, as you know, you sort of evoke in the book, but that... It's a very ordinary world in a way that we weren't used to seeing that on TV.
But what baffles me now is I heard from so many people that their 12-year-old son is obsessed with The Office. I hear it over and over from so many people. And even like Billie Eilish, you know, who became obsessed with it as a teenager. So why do you think so many young people see this show as such a landmark thing that they watch over and over again?
I don't know. That's something I wouldn't necessarily predict it. It's really weird how the show appeals to people who haven't had a job. And it's funny because it seems like it's designed more for people to recognize, oh, there's that guy in this office and this person in that office. And the way it sort of accurately captures, you know, office life. But for it to be so evergreen and popular with kids... It's really kind of nutty. I'm hearing specifically a lot of that right now during the quarantine times. A lot of people are like, yeah, my 10-year-old or my 12-year-old or my 14-year-old is going through the entire run of The Office. And it's kind of mind-blowing for me because, you know, for someone like Billie Eilish, who will never be in an office. We don't know what the rest of her life holds, but she will never have to use a stapler. For stuff like that to resonate with her, it says something about the show.
Right. You know, and in the book, I write lots about the casting, and I saw the names that they bandied about, that they talked about Dave Chappelle, you know, as like Michael Scott for a second. They talked about Dan Aykroyd, about Rick Moranis, about Philip Seymour Hoffman, about Paul Giamatti. I mean, it was insane, but they basically settled on the end at Bob Odenkirk. Do you think that could have worked?
No chance. And I love Odenkirk. Odenkirk is always a smart guy. You would never believe him as a dumb guy. He's just sort of got that innate intelligence, whatever kind of character he's playing. That's why, you know, it totally like tore a hole in Little Women when he showed up as the dad halfway through the movie. I saw Little Women in the theater and the entire audience laughed for a solid minute. He just was not able to play the role of a simple-minded small-town preacher. And that for him is as... you can't picture him as Michael Scott.
No. And for Dwight, it was almost Seth Rogen or Patton Oswalt. Do you think either of them could have been Dwight?
They would have been very different from Dwight, but they would have both been brilliant. They definitely both would have been brilliant in their different ways. I mean, they would have taken it in their own way. Rainn Wilson also was such an unknown quantity. You know, it was almost like he had dropped from another universe, so we didn't have a sense of any, you know, baggage that he was bringing into this before. It's weird because it seemed like Steve Carell was already a known quantity, which is kind of like ridiculous now, because of course, no, we'd seen just a fraction of what he could do. But it seemed at the time like he was a fairly well-established C or D level comedy star.
Yeah, I think the casting of the show is so crucial. And I spoke to Allison Jones, who's an unheralded like genius of television, that she cast Golden Girls and Curb Your Enthusiasm, Veep, and Freaks and Geeks, and Arrested Development. I mean, I can't think of a better batting average than that, than those shows, right? Isn't that amazing?
Well, and particularly in terms of those are shows where the specialty is a deep bench, you know, where like finding, curating all these people to populate this ecosystem. And, you know, so yes, Allison Jones is a total genius. And it's funny you mentioned Veep. I was going to ask you about Veep because so similar to The Office in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you're right. And that's one of the other great sitcoms of the 2000s. But most of those great shows are on HBO or something. That to be a great show on a network is a tough thing because you're trying to appeal to such a mass audience. I mean, do you think of The Office, if it was an HBO, that would have been a better show or a very different show or what?
Very different show. It wouldn't have been as Scranton-esque. It wouldn't have had that ordinariness. I mean, like Veep, like we were talking before about the sort of the, you know, the curated Paul Simon album making approach. You know, like Veep does like 8 episodes a season. It's much more on the UK model. You know, like the famous Ricky Gervais line about making The Office. He said, "I did 6 episodes. I needed to have a lie down. A year goes by, and okay, we'll try another 6." And whereas, you know, the frantic pace of The Office in terms of, you know, there's always another episode, just so many of them, it informs every episode of the show because there's, you know, it's very different from the sort of the HBO sitcom model where there's only, you know, a small number of extremely curated episodes.
Yeah, I spoke to a bunch of the best writers and they told me that doing 26 a year, that almost killed them. And some of them, they said, look, if you watch even the best seasons, that the finale is always great, but the 4 or 5 before it are often pretty weak because we were so burned out. And so, you know, I do notice that. You know, it's sort of interesting how some sitcoms just last, that they last for decades, that I Love Lucy is still around. Do you think The Office in 20, 30 years is still going to be watched?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know about you. I definitely think it will be. And I think it's sort of passed over the zone. I think that's almost incontrovertible at this point, that it's passed over the zone where if it were going to expire, it would have expired already. It's already, as astronomers say, it's cleared its neighborhood. You know, Pluto's not a planet because it hasn't cleared its neighborhood. Whereas The Office, it has broken loose of its neighborhood. It's very comparable to Seinfeld in terms of a show that I think of as different from The Office as it could possibly be in so many ways, but with this astounding longevity, especially with younger viewers, you know, like that 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, they're into The Office and they're into Seinfeld, when we both think of those shows as sort of capturing a moment in time and a moment in the culture. But clearly there's something timeless about both of them.
Do you think The Office changed TV in big ways?
I could be flip and say it, I wish it changed it a little more. I think it's had its impact more on the sort of on the sort of more UK-ish sort of series, you know, the HBO ones that we were talking about. But I don't think you can say that there's really been shows that have sort of inherited from The Office and sort of continued where it left off. Parks and Rec sort of started out that way and became something so totally different.
And that was made by the same creative team. It's sort of a spiritual spinoff. It's like, sort of.
Yeah. Almost like Seinfeld in the sense of them being so perfect at their formula that it seems like everybody wants to copy it, but it's almost impossible to do. It's weird, like, how much I think of Seinfeld in connection with The Office, especially because if you watch them together, you know, you look at Seinfeld, nobody has a job. Even the episodes where, like, Elaine has a funny job or George has a funny job, it's never really a job. And Seinfeld is always like, oh, I have to get on a plane and play a show and, you know, in Denver or something like that. There's never any of that sort of Scranton quality to Seinfeld. That's you know, that's kind of the appeal in a way. So it's funny for me that those two shows are both shows that have such a timeless appeal, and their appeal to younger viewers is something that's constantly fascinating to me.
Yeah, and Friends too, which is so different than The Office. I mean, I can name a million things. It's the opposite in some ways. But yeah, those are almost like the two biggest shows of the past quarter century almost.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but I thought my perception, which was probably wrong, I thought that Friends sort of went away in terms of pop culture for about 10 years. I don't remember it being as like dominant in people's minds as 10 years ago as it is now. Seinfeld, it's like nothing, it's like it never went off the air, basically. So Seinfeld and The Office have sort of continued unabated. Steve Martin has a great part in his book where he talks about when he was on tour in the 70s, and he said that, you know, his life was topsy-turvy. He was a touring comedian, but he said, every day I woke up and I turned on the TV, the hotel room TV, and I found the showing of the Brady Bunch at 3 p.m. No matter what town I was in, the UHF station was always showing the Brady Bunch, same time, it was always 3 p.m. And he said, that was the one way I sort of could orient myself no matter where I was traveling or what I was going through. The Office is very much a show of that ilk. It's something, it's always on, and you're always excited when you're flipping channels and you find one and you're like, ooh, what one is this? And whether you've seen it or not, you're always excited to see it.
Yeah, and I think it's a truly rare thing in our pop culture universe that it can be enjoyed by hipsters and teenagers and parents and children and even like red state Republicans and blue state Democrats. It crosses so many boundaries, which is rare these days when shows are so specialized.
Absolutely. What do you think of it, of its impact / influence on TV afterwards? I mean, do you think it's had a impact?
I think it briefly did. I think it briefly led to Modern Family, which I'm not a huge fan of, and Parks and Rec, and in some way to like Community. But I spoke to a bunch of the writers in the book who told me that they're bummed out that it didn't change TV more. Because the show, as big as it was never a juggernaut that The Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men just slayed it. I mean, they got much bigger ratings, and I think it's hard to replicate. I think so much of it is a sensibility of the people that ran it that you can't clone it. That I would have thought that TV now, it would be populated by clones of The Office, but they didn't come.
No, they didn't. I wonder why that is. Do you think it's because formally it kind of looks like reality TV?
Yeah, and I think that other networks, I think if you're CBS, you look at The Office as sort of a noble quasi-failure at the time, that it was never a juggernaut, that NBC was a distant fourth then, that they lost Frasier and Friends and Will and Grace all at once, and Seinfeld was long gone. And The Office, it sort of embodied like a critical like favorite, and there was a moment where it was successful in season 4 and 5, you know, hit. But I don't think it was ever big enough to inspire copycats. So back to the reboot thing out of earlier, do you think the odds are high that there'd be some sort of an Office reboot?
I don't, for kind of the reasons that you alluded to. Basically, for it to happen, Steve Carell would have to have a motive to do it. He's not going to fuck up his career to the point where he has to do that.
I think even if they could get him back, if Michael Scott is married and has children and he's in love and he's happy, then what's the show?
Yeah, they kind of effectively killed the character by growing him up. There's this moment in his last episode where he throws away his world's greatest boss mug. What does he do with it exactly? Does he give it away, throw it away?
He just chucks it in his garbage can.
Such a shocking moment, but it's kind of a thing of like, he does that, he can't walk back from that, you know? Like, he was like a Greek warrior in the Iliad who's burning his ships, you know? He's not going back to Greece. He's on the beach at Troy. He's going to stay there. And that they were able to do that, again, like we were saying before, without pulling the rug out from under him, that they let him sort of mature and stay a functional human being. They kind of can't redo the show around him, and it would look really sad and embarrassing if they did it without him. It would look like, you know, the Happy Days reboot, where, you know, we didn't have the Fonz, or the WKRP in Cincinnati reboot, where it only had Herb and Les and Mr. Carlson and nobody else from WKRP. No Dr. Johnny Fever.
Yeah, and I think we all want reboots until we get them. They bring back Mad About You, and it's everybody. It's even the minor characters, and 5 minutes in, you're like, I'm bored.
Yeah, it's weird. It's really brilliant way to put it. We want the comedy reboots until we get them. It's really weird to think that 5 years ago, it was so common for people to pray that there would be a revival of Arrested Development.
Yeah.
And this is something that people wished for so fervently, something that people, like, you know, lit prayer candles for, sacrificed animals, you know, to Zeus, hoping that this would happen. And within 30 seconds of you know, the first one's going live, it was like, oh my God, what a disaster. Why did we want this to happen?
Yeah, I think of Murphy Brown or something, or in movies like Dumb and Dumber 2, that I think great shows are a moment in time and a moment in their lives of the writers and the actors. And when they would ask Linda McCartney and Paul about a Beatles reunion, she'd say, you can't reheat a souffle.
I think you're right. I think something that I could see happening is if they just keep The Office and just repopulate the people, it would have to be done like that. It would have to be like plugging in a new cast, new characters, you know, same desks, same carpet, but just sort of putting different people in there. I think that could work. But, you know, how do you assemble a cast like that? But also, there's just so many people. That's why I think of it in terms of Veep, because Veep has so many people, and they're all so good. And even the people who get one line every three episodes are so great that you're like, oh my God, that person. So like Veep has to set the record since The Office of how many characters we are super excited when they show up, but you know, there's just so many of them. And they keep adding new ones the way The Office did for years.
Yeah, I think it's not going to happen. I sort of hope it's not going to happen. It's a beautiful thing, and they shouldn't ruin it.
Do you worry that you might, with your book, be helping to make it happen?
I think Greg Daniels is pretty smart and is not going to do it. I worry about NBC, but I think if they do it, it will be so short-lived that it'll just be a small after thing that'll be forgotten.
With these characters, you know, you think of these characters as having sort of, it's a cliche to say that the characters grew up with us, but we did spend a lot of our years sort of, you know, with them. Are there characters now that you worry or wonder where they'd be, who they'd be by this time? Like, are Jim and Pam still together at this point?
I think they are, but yeah, I think Jim and Pam are maybe for longer. I'm not sure about Angela and Dwight. God, the finale don't Kelly and Ryan, they run off together?
God, I repressed that memory entirely. Finales aren't really canon, though.
Yeah, so I think the real doomed characters are Kelly and Ryan. I think they're doomed for a lifetime of drama and sorrow and disappointment.
Yeah, and you wonder about them adjusting to a different world too. I remember something. Michael J. Fox was very, you know, when he, after Family Ties, when he became a movie star, he was very, often very funny, like speculating publicly about Alex P. Keaton and how, like, you know, eventually he would have gone to jail for insider trading. Michael J. Fox always enjoyed speculating on, like, how different, you know, like, these characters' life would have gone from his. But it's funny, I think you're right about Kelly and Ryan. I would worry about both of them.
Yeah, wow. I think that should do it, Rob. Thank you.
Thank you for doing this book. Again, The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. Andy Green from Dutton. It's a one-of-a-kind epic history of an archetypal classic American comedy. I think this book is a classic. And there's so much in it. I'm still absorbing all your stories. Like I said, I've been reading this book for upwards of a year, and I'm still learning new stuff from it because, like The Office itself, there's just so much.
Wow. I couldn't say better myself. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Andy, and congratulations.
Why, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Books Connect Us. For more great book recommendations and information about your favorite authors, feel free to follow Penguin Random House on social media or visit penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps more listeners to find our show. This podcast is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. I've been Erin Leaf, and until next time, this has been Books Connect Us.